Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. Thank you for listening in. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, here with...
Dennis Hart. And you know what, Ursula? I did not need an alarm clock this morning because that thunder banger woke me up even before the alarm could go off. That was a nice little storm.
Yep, rain and storms are predicted for most of today, especially later in the day and tonight. And Tuesday we'll see less chance, but still some possibility of rain and stormy weather. Sun is expected only a little bit, and temperatures should get high around 86. So we're still not quite done with summer. It seems like there'll be a good chance of rain most of the week, with temperatures in the 80s during the days and 60s at night, or even in the high 50s. And then starting on Friday, sunny days are expected to return, at least through the weekend.
Yeah, and we needed a little bit of rain, and we got a lot of rain today. The lawns had been starting to dry out. We hadn't had a lot this summer, but this was quite a little event this morning. Lightning, horizontal and vertical. Uh-huh. And I mean, I turned off the bedroom light to look at it. I'm not kidding. It almost blinded me, one of those lightning bolts that hit the ground. It was really
bright.
Yeah,
this is what my grandmother would call transition weather.
Yeah, exactly.
Transition weather. And speaking of transition,
yes.
Dennis, you and I have not had a chance to talk about the wild ones for a while, so we have a little bit of catching up to do.
I'm ready.
Okay. Well, first of all, I was driving on 13th Street west of Stang Road.
Yes.
And the car in front of me was driving at a clip of about 35 miles an hour, as they do.
Sure.
And all of a sudden, it came to quite a sudden slow. I was a good distance behind it, but all of a sudden it slowed down really dramatically and was crawling along.
Why did it slow down?
So I was like, okay, what, is this guy's having car problems?
Yes, yes.
But then he kind of went to the right lane and kept moving, and sure enough, there was four little baby raccoons playing in the middle of the street there.
Very
so
nice.
You got to make way for the raccoons. Yeah. And
speaking of raccoons, as we just were, yes.
Okay, I've got two stories. This is wild ones on the dark side, okay?
Ooh,
and
ooh.
My apologies if I offend anybody, but people are starting to tell me their wild one stories.
Yeah, because they're listening to this.
Because they hear this.
Yeah.
And so I was talking to some the other day, and this is what she told me. She said, I saw a spider out in the garden, and the spider had grabbed a monarch butterfly and was wanting to wrap it up and eat it.
Ooh.
And or I guess they first have to decay a little bit before they eat it. But anyway, he was getting ready to wrap up the monarch, and this person, you know, doesn't want the monarchs to go extinct.
Sure.
So she decided she had to save the monarch. So she rushed over to save the monarch, and she tripped on something and cut her foot open. She did manage to actually save the monarch, but she was sitting there unwrapping the monarch and doing that and in pain, and all of a sudden she feels this funny little tickling feeling on her foot, and she looks down, and a wasp is sitting on her leg, and it's licking up the blood.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. Do I believe this story? She gave blood to save the monarch, and now the wasp is sucking up the blood. Holy cow. Okay.
So, just to lighten things up a little, another person knows who they are, was at a party, and they had a little bit too much of something, and went outside and ended up puking in the yard. And he was lying in the ground, kind of feeling better and trying to recover. And all of a sudden, he also hears a little lapping sound nearby, and a little rustling and a lapping, and so he looks up in his state, and there's a raccoon. Lapping up his puke.
No. This is not right.
Sharing the good times.
Boy, I'll tell you, rainy days and Mondays get me down, and so do these stories sometimes.
So
wow.
My apologies for the disgusting... Well, you've got something, right?
I do, and this is on a little higher level than where we were just now. This comes, I kid you not, from the New York Times last week. It's about squirrels. Okay, and you know I'm always on a very high level when I'm talking about wild ones here. Researchers at Oberlin College reported last week that squirrels pay attention not only to alarm calls, as many animals do, but also to the background chatter of birds.
Huh.
And that squirrels relax a bit when the birds sound relaxed. In other words, if the birds are chattering, the squirrels take notice because they think there's danger. But if they're just doing their normal talking between each other, the birds, the squirrels understand this and they are relaxed. Is that amazing?
That is amazing. It's not hard to believe, though, but it's really my respect to the squirrels, very mm-hmm. aware of their surroundings. But, that's very nice to hear. So there's kind of a collective collective ambiance going on
yeah.
that the squirrels are checking out.
And the way the researchers did this, they—
But, you know, people do that, too. People notice when birds are upset.
Well, yeah, especially if they're birds like in the Hitchcock movie. Well, if those things come after me, believe me, I'm upset. Okay.
Anyway, call
this
me
is
what
very
you're saying.
No. This is a very high level discussion we're having this morning.
Right,
I understand. But the way they tested this was in the wild, they listened to birds, and if the birds sounded okay, great. The squirrels were very calm. But then they played a recording. They took a recorder out to the field, a recorder, and they played the screech of a red-tailed hawk.
Oh,
and
wow.
And that put the squirrels on alert and caused them to be vigilant. Then they played recordings of desultory bird chatter, just regular background mm-hmm. stuff that they were doing, and the squirrels were all calm, cool and calm. And that just shows you that they do on their level, and we don't know what that level is, birds and animals communicate between
yeah.
each other and with each other.
Yeah.
And that's just amazing to me. It really is.
That is amazing. Yeah, it is. It kind of makes me realize there's a lot going on there with the wild ones.
And we have no idea.
And actually, your story reminds me of something I saw when I was in upstate New York at my sister's ashram. I was sitting out on her porch, and there was this – and all these little songbirds, lots and lots and lots of little songbirds, all started flying towards a tree.
Uh-huh.
I was like, what is going on? Like all these different birds. And all of a sudden, there was this racket in the trees, and a hawk came bursting out of the trees with all of the songbirds – flying after it mm-hmm. with the blue jays in the lead. Mm-hmm. And they had all ganged up together to mm-hmm. roust out a hawk who was probably too close to somebody's nest.
Yep.
So not only do they listen to each other, the birds are all capable of ganging up
yes.
together. And, of course, the blue jays think they're the police. So
yes,
they're in the
yes.
lead.
I have a hawk story, a quick one.
Okay.
Last week saw a hawk in a backyard next to our place, and it was sitting on a power pole. The hawk was just sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
And I came into the station that day. When I went back home, the hawk was there. So I had to do other things, but my wife noticed what was going on. The hawk stayed there virtually the entire day and finally found something that he could eat or she could eat. So we looked this up. The hawks are in their migration pattern right now. They're going from north to south. This hawk was on his migration, waiting long enough to find some food, and it took him hours. He stayed on top of that power pole and did not move until he found a mouse or whatever it was he was looking for. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
He needed it.
He needed the fuel.
He
right?
had to do it. He couldn't go any farther.
Yeah.
How they know that, I have no idea. They're smart. They're very smart.
And finally, my dad came home the other night, and he looked at me with dreamy eyes.
Really?
And he said, last night, I saw a deer standing in the ISU cemetery.
Okay.
Okay, Dennis, I'm going to hand it over to you. Give us some news.
I'll give you the news from around the state of Iowa this past week. There was a lot of it, including word that Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds had appointed a top health official from Texas to lead the state's Human Services Department. The new director, Kelly Kennedy Garcia, who begins work November 1st, the governor said she chose Garcia because she loved her passion and energy. She is now Deputy Executive Commissioner for the Texas Health and Human Services Commission, and she replaces Jerry Foxhoven, who resigned in June. Foxhoven has filed a $2 million wrongful discharge claim against the state of Iowa over the circumstances surrounding his departure. Meanwhile, last week, State Auditor Rob Sands said he does not think taxpayers should pay the legal costs to appeal a $1.5 million judgment against Iowa and against former Governor Terry Branstad for discriminating against a gay former state official. This past July, a jury awarded former Iowa Workers' Compensation Commissioner Chris Godfrey the judgment. Total expenses for the case could be millions of dollars more. Also last week, word that Iowa Democrats still looking for ways to make their upcoming presidential caucuses more accessible. This after the Democratic National Committee had rejected state Democrats' plans to hold virtual caucuses where participants could take part by telephone. And there was word that the Republican Party of Iowa will hold its traditional straw poll at its caucus meetings next February, even when other states are planning to cancel their GOP primaries and caucuses in a show of support for President Trump. Also last week, a report that Iowa is among a group of states launching an antitrust investigation into Facebook. That investigation will focus on Facebook's industry dominance. Another state coalition set to announce a separate investigation, this one into Google, later today. Also word last week that Iowa's Republican U.S. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst had told business leaders that they supported recruiting more migrant labor here. Grassley said there's not a deep enough talent pool of workers in Iowa. Ernst said she's also open to increasing the number of employment visas. There was more last week, including a report that a survey of business supply managers in the Midwest showed they expected either slow or no economic growth over the next several months, in part because of the trade wars the United States is involved with. The Mid-American Business Conditions Index covers 9 states, including Iowa. 2/3 of the supply managers who responded to that survey said the trade wars and tariffs were harming their companies. At the University of Iowa last week, President Bruce Harreld said that legalized sports betting in the state requires both vigilance and transparency. From the U of I's athletic department, Harreld said that even casual comments about the health of an athlete could tip the scales when it comes to casino betting. It is now legal, as you know, to bet on sporting events in Iowa, but it's still a violation of NCAA rules for any athlete, coach, or athletic staff member to place any bets. There was a strange story involving a Des Moines public school student last week. The male student jumped from the roof of a 2-story building at Brody Middle School and landed on the lawn below. He suffered undisclosed injuries. District officials did not release the boy's age or his grade. Also last week, word that the parents of a 5-year-old boy with Down syndrome are suing the Ankeny School District's transportation contractor after a school bus carrying special needs students took hours to return children to their homes and daycare centers. It is the second lawsuit filed against the bus contractor in the incident last May. In the new lawsuit against Durham School Services, parents Nathan and Andrea Keith say their son, who wears leg braces, rode for nearly 3 hours before he was dropped off. There was also news last week that some of the biggest companies in Metro Des Moines are fighting their property assessments. They claim the Polk County assessor has overvalued their properties, potentially costing them hundreds of thousands of dollars in property taxes. Among those fighting their assessments, Nationwide Insurance and Wellmark Blue Cross and Blue Shield. Meanwhile, a group of Des Moines business and civic leaders announced plans last week to take control of the Des Moines Social Club and redevelop the downtown venue into year-round public market. The project would cost about $7 million. The announcement came about 3 months after the Social Club said it was facing financial trouble. The Social Club was founded 11 years ago and showcases local artists, theater, and bands, and also offered community classes. Also last week, word that the state of Iowa had received a $33 million federal grant to improve bridges around the state. The Competitive Highway Bridge Program will help bring 77 bridges that are now either in poor or fair condition up to good condition. And the city of Des Moines and its community partners were awarded almost $2 million to help homeless youth. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development awarded that grant as part of the National Youth Homelessness Demonstration Program. In the world of business, the Iowa maker of Blue Bunny ice cream announced it would buy a manufacturing plant out west in Henderson, Nevada. That would be the 5th facility in Blue Bunny's production lineup. The Lamar's company said the purchase would expand its manufacturing capacity and make it easier to meet growing demand for the product in the West. Blue Bunny employs about 4,000 people across the nation. It is the biggest privately held family-owned ice cream maker in the United States. Meanwhile, there was word last week that the Iowa Department of Public Safety had denied a request by the Associated Press to release a list of about 24 former criminal offenders who had been improperly granted credentials to work for private security firms. This coming after the discovery that the department had granted nearly 6,000 private security employees credentials without having them undergo mandatory federal background checks. There was also a report that stickers promoting a white nationalist hate group had been seen last week near the Science Center of Iowa in Des Moines. City workers took down those stickers. There was also word that the top official of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration had toured the campus of the University of Iowa. Jim Bridenstine went to campus a few months after a team of Hawkeye researchers had snagged a record-breaking $115 million contract to study weather in space. Students and professors lined up to show him some of the many projects that are underway on that campus. In the world of animals last week, a report that pig-ear dog treats, that's right, pig-ear dog treats, had infected nearly 24 Iowa residents with salmonella in the past year. That's more than in any other state. Pig ears are linked to a drug-resistant salmonella outbreak in 35 states. Symptoms of salmonella in humans include diarrhea, fever, and stomach cramps. Some dogs that have a salmonella infection may not look sick. Moving from pig's ears to the actual pig, there was an update last week on a story that made a big splash during the Iowa State Fair. You probably remember it. It was about a man who complained to fair officials after he saw a boy allegedly mistreating a pig at the fair. The fair wound up banning the complaining man from the fair for life. Well, last week, the Des Moines Register reported that fair officials had investigated and discovered that the youngster who had been seen lashing out at the pig was helping his family move the animal and was not an FFA competitor. As a result, the fair will take no action against the boy. Meanwhile, there are still hard feelings on the part of almost everyone concerned. In the world of college football this past weekend, you probably know the University of Iowa defeated Rutgers 30-0. The University of Northern Iowa defeated Southern Utah 34-14. Iowa State University had the weekend off, but this coming weekend, get ready, ISU hosts the University of Iowa at Jack Trice Stadium. That's a very big deal indeed, and you know what? It just got even bigger with word that the ESPN College Football Game Day crew is coming to Ames for the game. That's right, for the very first time, ESPN's popular college football pregame show is going to originate on Cy-Hawk Saturday from the grassy area between Hilton Coliseum and the Scheman Building. Yes, this coming Saturday is going to be quite a day indeed. One more note from last week. Word of the death of an Iowa man who made oh so big an impact 40 years ago. His name, Joe Hayes. And for much of his life, he was known as the man who had brought the Pope to Iowa. That's right, it was Joe Hayes who wrote a letter to Pope John Paul II inviting the Pope to visit the Heartland during the Pontiff's scheduled tour of the United States 40 years ago next month. And that led to one of the most iconic events in Iowa history. Because on October 4th, 1979, Pope John Paul II did come to Iowa, to Urbandale's Living History Farms. To be exact, 350,000 people attended that event. On a personal note, my wife Sharon and I had just moved to Ames a couple of months earlier. I had been hired to teach journalism at Iowa State. We were astounded, as everyone else around these parts was, to hear that the Pope was coming. Well, we did not get to go to Living History Farms that day, but we and everyone else who did not get to go watched the event live on TV. It was an amazing day. And to this very moment, 40 years later, I remember that KCCI-TV's Russ Van Dyke opened the station's 10 o'clock newscast that night with these immortal words. The Pope has come and gone, but the memory of his visit will live forever. Russ was absolutely right about that visit, but he probably never thought that his iconic opening line that night on Channel 8's news would also live in my memory forever. In fact, when I was teaching journalism at Iowa State and elsewhere, I used that line in my classes because it would stay in everyone's memory. Good for Russ Van Dyke. And all of this was brought about because Joe Hayes, a farmer from Truro, Iowa, had the audacity to write a letter to the Pope. Joe Hayes was 78 years old when he died. And the memory of what he did, that will indeed live forever. And that is your summary of the week's news from around the state.
Hialeah by Harold Lopez Noose.
Very nice. And this is Local Talk Monday, 20 minutes after the hour. And I'm Dennis Hart, your host today, along with Ursula Rudenberg. Well, you know, it's early to be talking about the Iowa caucuses, but as I reported just minutes ago, Democratic National Party people made a decision last week changing the direction of how the party's going to handle caucus night. As the Des Moines Register reported on August 30th, the Democratic National Committee on Friday unraveled months of progress the Iowa Democratic Party had made toward making its caucuses more accessible and inclusive, throwing the process into turmoil. The DNC announced it would not recommend approval of plans by Iowa and the state of Nevada to enact virtual caucuses, citing broad cybersecurity concerns. Now, that rejection upends Iowa's plans just 5 months before caucus night, adding another layer of uncertainty to what's always been a complicated, volunteer-driven exercise in organizing. And it calls into question the long-term viability of the Iowa caucus system, as Democrats here debate whether expanding access outweighs the importance of being first. Now, if you caucused in 2016, you might have been among those who experienced problems when many venues were not big enough to accommodate the high turnout on that night. There was a national directive to expand access to the caucuses, and an initial plan had been released earlier this year to fulfill that directive. Well, in July, Iowa party officials said the caucus could be accessible by phone. They were trying to work on plans for that. The state of Nevada had proposed a similar plan for its caucuses, which also occur in February. Online virtual conferencing or another secure method had also been mentioned.
But last week, those methods were vetoed on the national level, and this raises the question of how Iowa will comply with the directive for expanding access, and also how keeping the nature and intent of the caucuses will interact with any sort of plan. There is now a very short turnaround for such a resolution, really just a matter of weeks, I think almost just 2 weeks. To flesh this out some, Lily Bolke, who is our presidential election reporter here at KHOI, spoke with Douglas Jones in Iowa City about these developments. Jones is a computer scientist at the University of Iowa who researches computer security, particularly in electronic voting. He chaired the Iowa Board of Examiners for Voting Machines and Electronic Voting Systems from 1999 to 2003 and has testified numerous times before federal voting commissions and committees on voting issues. He's also the co-author of a book on electronic voting entitled Broken Ballots. Will your vote count?
Yes, vote.
Jones has been outspoken in his opposition to teleconferencing or a virtual conference. He began his recorded interview with Lily by explaining why he was opposed to them, and he also is suggesting an alternative plan of action. In so doing, he spells out some of what is inherent in what makes the process a viable form of democracy.
I cannot for the life of me figure out whether they even thought about the kinds of issues that come up with a high-profile public event like this. In the first place, I'm not terribly impressed with the contractors that they were mentioning. One of them is a telephone call contractor that does spam telephone calling for a business. Telespam, I guess, would be the modern word. And the other one seems to be a small company that's never really done anything big before. So running a telephone substitute for a caucus would be something where there would be really no opportunity for failure. If you do anything wrong, it's such a big event and such a headline event that everyone is going to notice it and everyone is going to come down hard. And yet they weren't even proposing to have some kind of dry run or open to the public, see if you can hack it event to basically verify that they have something that'll actually work. That's layer one of my objections. Layer two of my objections is, suppose we had the absolutely most competent company coming forward, and I had no questions at all about their ability to pull it off. Then I would ask, how do you verify that the person phoning is actually an authorized participant? What kind of authentication do we use? If you show up at the caucus site, the rules are the same as for a polling place. You're signing a register, you're being checked off against the poll book. You are in a situation where there are a bunch of people who come from your neighborhood also there who are very likely to recognize you, and it would be really hard to fake it. But by telephone, it could be Joe Blow from Siberia. How do we know? And then there's the third layer of objection. This is a caucus. Iowa has an agreement with New Hampshire that New Hampshire gets the first primary, and Iowa only gets to go ahead of New Hampshire because we're a caucus and not a primary. the definition of a primary, as far as I'm concerned, is an event where people cast ballots and that's all they do. And the telephone thing that's been proposed comes very dangerously close to just casting a ballot and then having a ballot tabulation process determine the winner. And that's not a caucus. The most I could do with that is put caucus in quotes and say a quote caucus, unquote. Because a caucus is at its heart a deliberative assembly, and even our most broken caucuses we've had, and I must say 3.5 years ago the caucus system was on the verge of breaking because we simply had too many people and no way of really accommodating them. But nonetheless, you have motions, you have debate, you have discussion, and there's no way to carry that out in the proposed telecaucus. And yet, the wheeling and dealing that goes on in a caucus to get delegates to the county convention who are at least initially committed to your candidate is a very real thing, which causes people to take into account political considerations, which you don't do in just stepping into a polling booth and checking off a box on your ballot.
What do you think would be a secure method to make some kind of virtual caucus more verified and caucus-like?
Well, I've been thinking about this because I'm one of the people who was saying this virtual caucus that was proposed was a bad idea. And, you know, as one of the naysayers, I sort of feel I owe it to suggest an alternative. And the best alternative I can propose is something that wouldn't involve telephones at all, but would involve doing something completely different from the whole absentee ballot idea. And that is proxy voting, where you allow people to sign over their proxy for participation in the caucus to someone else from their precinct who agrees with them politically enough that they're willing to let that other person act as their agent. The whole caucus process in Iowa is fundamentally representative democracy. The precinct elects delegates to the county convention, which elects delegates to the district and state conventions. And those delegates at the district and state level are representing the people at the precincts who elected the county delegates. So it is a system where we rely on representation. And the whole idea of proxies would be one which takes this representative idea one level farther, where a person in agreeing to carry someone else's proxy is agreeing to represent them, and a person in signing over their proxy is signing it over to someone who they feel could represent them. I've seen proxy voting used in national elections in other countries. It works well, but has all of the same problems that absentee voting has. Absentee voting is famous for a variety of abuses which apply whether you're doing it by mail or by internet or anything else. Proxy voting seems to have all the same problem.
What are some of those problems?
The classic problem is, for example, someone from a nursing home who files absentee ballots on behalf of all their patients with Alzheimer's disease. Turns out they had the same problem in the Netherlands where they use proxy voting instead of absentee ballots. And again, a nurse showed up at the polling place with a stack of proxies from all of her Alzheimer's patients. That's where the Dutch decided to put in the limit of 3 proxies per voter. And the French, incidentally, have the same limit for similar reasons. In Iowa, we simply made it illegal to file absentee ballots from nursing home addresses. So, I mean, these kind of abuses seem to be a problem with every form of voting where the voter doesn't show up in person at the event. We need to deal with them independently of the issue of whether it's proxies or telephone caucuses. But the key thing is proxy voting allows the caucus to continue as a deliberative assembly. It allows people at the caucus to represent not only themselves, but their neighbors who've agreed to have them as a representative. Proxy voting would encourage people in the neighborhood to talk to each other. It would encourage people to think hard about what they were doing before they show up at the caucuses. And proxy voting could allow us to have smaller caucuses representing more voters. And I would also say you can't have unlimited proxies, not like corporate world where you have a stack of 1,000 proxies in your hand. This should be something like a 4 proxy per voter or 3 proxy per voter limit, so that one person could represent, say, their wife who couldn't make it, and maybe their neighbors who couldn't make it. So that's my best proposal that I've been able to come up with as an alternative. The DNC and the Iowa Democratic Central Committee have both seen this in email forms.
Do you think there is any technology that could be incorporated that would be secure?
Given the current technological landscape in the United States, I'm really skeptical whether we have any solution we could put in place in time for this round of elections, which is why I've proposed a very low-tech solution. This proxy idea of mine does not require much in the way of technology at all. If you want security, several major ingredients required for secure computing simply are not available. The list is extraordinarily long. There is no what's called a public key infrastructure, which would be a cryptographic framework which we could run on as a nation that would allow us to be sure that people are who they say they are when they're dealing electronically. It turns out there's no known way to verify that the software that's running on your device is the same as the software that's authorized to be running on that device, whether it's a cell phone or a desktop computer. It's estimated that on the order of a third of all desktop PCs are infected with malware. If someone were intent on cooking an election that was conducted using PC technology, it's pretty clear that a third of all PCs should not be used for casting votes. The story on cell phones is less severe, but there are cell phone viruses, and there are an awful lot of cell phone apps that to install the app, you actually have to give the app access to everything you're doing. And this is really scary because all kinds of tracking is going on using these. And unfortunately, tracking could include eavesdropping and potentially could include interfering with transactions. To date, the eavesdropping issue is the one people have paid the most attention to. It's amazing how many apps there are that basically you install it because you wanted to have, say, a desk calculator app on your iPad. So you install the calculator app and you don't know that it's actually monitoring everything you do on your iPad and allowing them to track and monetize that, which usually means selling advertising. And it seems to be at this point ubiquitous. This is very discouraging. It's very hard to find a secure computing platform out in the general world these days.
Earlier you mentioned that the last caucus was a little bit problematic because of just how many people there were.
I've run one of Iowa's larger caucuses 3.5 years ago. I was co-chair of a caucus. So the caucus that I was involved in running, we had seats for 250 people. We had over 650 people show up, and the result was that over half the people who showed up couldn't even fit in the room. Mm. So my wife and I were co-chairs. She stood at the podium with her cell phone on, and everything she said I had to repeat by bellowing over the edge of the balcony over the foyer of the building where the rest of the crowd was. And then she had to remember to listen to me when someone wanted to ask a question from back where I was bellowing to. I really needed a bullhorn. I didn't have one. I came out of that evening utterly hoarse. That was preposterous. And the problem is that I don't know of a big enough venue in my precinct. There is one megachurch, but that megachurch may actually have a federal contract that may prohibit them using the building for any political events, which includes caucuses but not election day. And there's a large concert hall, but the concert hall is booked up an awful lot, and you know they're constantly running concerts there. They don't want to do political events. So, you know, how do you find space for these gigantic events? I think basically the more the caucus comes close to being a high turnout primary, the less it works as a caucus. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to solve that problem. Although my proxy idea, maybe that could cut the turnout in half and yet we could actually represent more people. That might make something that we could live with. But is it going to be accepted by the political establishment? It takes acceptance by both the national and the state parties before something like this can go over. So I don't know that anyone had a fallback position in hand at the time that the negative recommendation came through. the possibility of proxies, at least it has precedent in the United States, and even better precedent if you look overseas. It can be made to work, and people who are in countries where proxy voting is a normal way to handle absentee voting problems think it's perfectly normal and don't understand our idea of having absentee ballots. So proxies could be workable. In fact, the DNC even uses proxies in some of their national meetings. So maybe we can make it work. The issue has to be settled at least 3 months in advance or we're in deep trouble, because it takes that long to print up all the packets and proofread all the instructions and get the details down in time for the caucus itself. So we're sort of at the hairy edge of what's safe at this point.
Thank you.
After all the jets are in the boxes and the clowns have all gone to bed, you can hear happiness staggering on down the street, footprints dressed in red, and the wind whispers clearly.
Jimi Hendrix, The Wind Cries Mary. Before that, Douglas Jones from the University of Iowa, an expert on election security. And The Wind Cries Mary, oh my, did we have some wind and lightning and thunder this morning. Quite a little thunderstorm. And fortuitously, Keith Morgan, the emergency coordinator for Story County, is with us on Local Talk on this Monday. And Keith, I had a crazy thought when I was in the shower this morning and that lightning storm was going. It was a pretty good storm. I knew you were going to be on the show, and I actually thought, you know, maybe I should get out of the shower, not because of any danger from lightning, but I thought we might lose power and I wouldn't be able to see anything. It's still dark. But now we find out that maybe I should have gotten out of the doggone shower during this storm.
Yeah, sure. That's one of the things people don't realize, exactly how powerful lightning is. It is one of the major killers when it comes to severe weather. And being in a shower, obviously, electricity likes to flow through copper pipes and through water and things like that. You're exposing yourself to danger by just being in the shower when the thunderstorm's coming through, the electrical storm's moving through.
Because if the lightning hits your house, it could go through the pipe and then the water gets electrified, is that right?
It can be in the water, and also it doesn't have to be a direct hit on the house. It can be a hit somewhat close to the house. The amount of energy in that lightning bolt is just phenomenal.
What other things shouldn't we be doing during a lightning storm in our house? Sometimes we just don't even think about these things. We're so enamored of the storm. What other dangers are there in our house?
If you're one of those people that have an actual phone that's plugged into the wall, again, the electricity can flow through those wires and into the phone. But most of us now have the ones that are remote handsets for it, so that's a lot safer. One of the big choices you've got is, how much of my electronics am I going to unplug from the wall? Because if it hits the house, it's going to get into the electrical system, and it will travel through that electrical system. Potentially, as sensitive as electronics are, it can take out the electronics.
Yeah, I've learned that the hard way. We've had a TV. The TV got blown up.
Really? During,
when there was a lightning striking in our yard. And also the doorbell was destroyed. It started ringing. And then it just blew out.
Yep.
So and the garage door also was destroyed.
A lot of things we just don't have any real perception of how much we use electronics around a house anymore. And all of these different things, refrigerators, everything that's plugged into the wall potentially can be damaged by the massive voltage of a lightning strike.
Now, you're not suggesting we should unplug our refrigerators, though, are you?
No, it's impractical. That's where I say that you have to look at what is practical. Think about how much time it would take you to go around and unplug absolutely everything in your house that's electronic. But if you have, your very expensive computer, electronics, or things like that, you can go for the surge protectors. They may protect you if you don't get a direct strike from a lightning bolt, but they'd have to be pretty massive to be able to take a direct hit.
And you would probably want to unplug the TV. And what about the telephone? If you have a landline, would you unplug that?
If you have a landline, they are powered by the actual wires in there. If you have one that actually has got a coil that goes into the phone, mm-hmm. that one you might want to unplug. Probably the best bet is just don't use it during that time frame. Anything else, and again, it comes down to how much time are you going to have to run around your house to right. unplug everything and then to replug in everything and reset the clocks and all that sort of stuff.
I would unplug the computer, though.
Yeah. If uh-huh. you had a high-end computer, definitely something to unplug. Uh-huh. But the main thing is don't be near anything that's going to transmit. And water, obviously, copper piping is one of those things that you just
– Dennis, you found a really weird story about that. Can you relate that about the woman who was washing dishes?
Yeah.
That really illustrates how – crazy lightning can be.
Yeah, there was a 17-year-old woman by the name of Faith Mobley was working at a McDonald's in Alabama washing dishes. This is last year, or a couple of years ago. She says, when I got the last dish to wash, and this was during a thunderstorm, I filled up the sink, and right when I put my hands in the water, lightning struck the McDonald's and the bank across the street. I saw a flash of light in front of my face, and it was so bright that it burned, and I almost fell backward. She had no idea what had happened in the moment. Later, she learned that the current had gone through the plumbing to the faucet into the standing water in the sink through her headset, and down her body.
Yeah.
Wearing one of those headsets that McDonald's people sometimes wear. And it shocked her. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, and that's inside. Think of we were talking about people that are doing sports outside when there's lightning storms. And you want to get that last hole of golf in, or, you know, it's 5 minutes until the end of the football game.
Right.
All of those, lightning can strike, 10 miles from the actual thunderstorm. So if you can hear it, it's time to go inside.
What if you're outside and you're in a field or something, as many farms have, or trees? Should you be away from the tree? I know you're not supposed to be underneath it, but what's the deal on that?
They do want you to be as low as possible away from a tree. Squat down. Don't lay down. So
you don't want to be horizontal, right?
You don't want to have a large contact area mm-hmm. with the surface. But you don't want to be the highest thing out there, because if you're the highest thing out there, or you're near the highest thing, because this stuff can hit whatever's high, and then it'll travel through the ground and can cause injury to you also. So that's you want to make yourself as small a target as possible, as low as possible.
You want to be away from wire fences too, don't you? Because, boy, those things can generate the shock.
Anything that can, like you said, be a conductor, uh-huh. things like that. It's definitely something to think about. And, one time when I lived out in New Mexico, I chose not to go to a great outdoor concert just because the weather forecast said it was going to be intense lightning. So
it's
just
dangerous.
Not worth it.
Especially
it's dangerous
if you've
stuff.
Got a whole mob of people there in a lightning storm. It's a pretty dangerous situation.
And in those cases, it doesn't have to be just the lightning itself. It's like you said, if all of a sudden people decide that it's time to leave now, you have that problem with a stampede.
Let's talk about driving. Is it safe to be driving a car in a thunderstorm where you have lightning? I've done this coming up from Des Moines to Ames, where the lightning's literally hitting at the side of I-35, and it scares the devil out of you, the lightning to the ground. Is it safe to be in your car driving?
Cars are supposed to be safe, kind of like that Faraday cage that we were talking about on there. Something you need to consider, though, especially if it's dark outside, is just being blinded by the lightning.
Right.
I have been out in some lightning storms that are so violent that it's just one flash after another. So, and with that, usually there's pretty heavy rain, and so you'd be driving along, especially at night. Next thing you know, you're in an intense downpour, and you can't see ahead of you.
So even if your car is hit by lightning, a very unlikely occurrence, but if it ever was, you're safe inside?
That's what they say. I'm not going to test it.
I never want to have that happen.
Yeah.
It's the rubber tires, right?
Tires, and also it's a cage around you. The electricity will hit the car, flow around you, and then try probably sooner or later jump off of that frame into the ground.
Wow.
You want to talk about the brightness of lightning. I turned off the bedroom light this morning right before I came to the station, and I wanted to see it. I wanted to see the lightning because mm-hmm. it was really bright. There was a flash to the ground just north of our place, probably several miles. So bright, I kid you not, it left stars in my eyes. It lit up the sky, lit up the day, and left a burned temporary impression in my eye. It was that light.
Blinded by the light.
Yeah.
Blinded by the light, yeah, or the lightning, yeah. Wow.
So, Keith, this is Preparedness Month, right?
It is. I'm sure you all have that on your calendars.
Yes. Starting today.
It is now. Okay, talk to us about what that means.
Well, you know, preparedness, just another reminder for people to walk through the processes when it comes to being prepared for any kind of disaster or emergency. You know, first off, look at those risks that are out there and mitigate them. Like you said, step out of the shower. Don't make yourself a victim by taking a shower during a lightning storm.
Or a bath, right?
Or bath would even be worse.
It would be worse, yeah.
You know, trimming up those trees to make sure they're not hanging over your house. Having good notification so that you can see this stuff coming and then have a plan in place to be able to protect yourself. Go in a lower place of the house if it's high winds. Take it seriously enough to get off the golf course or be prepared to minimize your risk out there. And then walk it all the way on through. And again, if your house should be hit by a tornado or high winds, do you have a little bit of food? Do you have at least 3 days worth of water? Do you have medicines to last long enough? An extra set of glasses, keys for your car. Is that all in one place to go? A wrench to turn off the natural gas. We were talking about the impact on some older natural gas piping that a lightning strike can cause pinholes in it that are undetectable, but then the natural gas starts to seep out. So walk through all of that stuff and then practice it. When any time, teachable moments, when something happens anywhere in the nation, get with your family, get with your business, because this applies to businesses also, and walk through what would have we done in that situation, especially when you hear stories of what happened. You could even take that story of the gal that got hit by the lightning. Mm-hmm. What would you do if you had somebody that happened? Who knows CPR around here? Who's going to call 911? Those sorts of things. And most importantly, believe it can happen to you.
That was my next question. You and I and Ursula have talked about this for years on this radio program. You've been here for a while. Emergency preparedness. Question to you. Do most people just think, never going to happen to me? I don't have to do this. That's all cool stuff, but I'm really not going to do it. You've had the experience with it. Do most people take this seriously?
So many do. Hopefully, most of them do finally get the idea that this is a dangerous situation in enough time to get away from it. But there are those that usually are injured or killed are those that haven't heeded it, have gone out to videotape the tornado coming towards them,
right,
as opposed to getting themselves secured. There are sometimes we talk about, unfortunately, active shooter. You know, that initial shock, if you're hearing something that sounds like gunfire, to take action and make sure that you're doing – you can always come back to the place, but if you don't, you might be trapped. So it's that recognition that it can happen.
Well, Keith, that's actually a situation that I think more than anything people have recently thought this could actually happen, or what if it would happen. The idea of a shooter.
Mm-hmm.
What should somebody look for or think about? I mean, what how can you prepare for that?
Make sure you know where your exits are. That is the first thing. A lot of times, even due to fires and like that, they will find, unfortunately, a lot of the casualties are by the door that they came in. Even though there may have been exits in the opposite direction that were perfectly accessible, everybody just, I know I came in this door, I'm going back out that door. When you walk into a place, figure out where the exits are and get in your mind how you would get to the closest exit. Just like when you go on an airline, you know, the closest exit may not be the best one for you. And then just keep aware of your situation. Keep, you don't need to be hyper-vigilant, but you just keep looking around. And if something doesn't look right, pay more attention to it and see where it develops from there.
It's interesting when you talk to a vet. That's what they always say too. They check out where the exits are when they're in a room.
Yeah, it's just something that you develop, and our law enforcement thinks that way too. If you own a business, train your employees. Try and give yourself a little bit more access control, which is great. But half the time, then they don't go the next step further. That person who has access control, what are you going to do if that person doesn't look quite right? They haven't done anything dangerous yet. But what can you do to verify that they're there and that keeping people informed within the business that, hey, we've just had these different people let go. If they come back, be paying close attention to them to make sure.
What do you look for?
If somebody's wearing clothing that is not, a long jacket on a cool day but not cold day, if they look agitated, stuff like that. And if you ask questions and all of a sudden they really start getting defensive, some people have a personality like that, but we're very Iowa nice. But it doesn't hurt to say, well, hi, I'm such and such, and what are you here for? Who are you here to see? Can I maybe help you get there? And kind of watch their reaction from there.
It really is a sign of the times. My wife and I had occasion to go to Washington, D.C. over the Labor Day weekend, flying to and from, and at the airport. I am now so attuned to looking all around at people, especially people who are waiting to get on the same flight I'm on. Now, that's wrong, probably, but it's the sign of the times. You're looking for anybody who doesn't look as if maybe they should be there, and that's crazy, but you do it.
And you've got to. Like I said, if somebody looks agitated or, unfortunately, like you, hypervigilant, it doesn't hurt to keep an extra little bit of a watch on them.
Yeah, and you always want TSA to go through every bit of luggage. I have no problem with what TSA does. I don't care how long it takes.
Exactly.
Yeah,
right.
You know, Dennis, if it makes you feel any better, I actually once reported two people on a transocean flight, and I got the really interesting experience of watching how an airplane crew handles checking somebody out. Very, very professional.
Yeah.
Turned out the person was not – they were not a danger. And they never even knew that they were being checked out, but I saw it happen. It's very, very interesting.
You know, we should also look for, at least I do when I'm on a plane, I look when people go to the restroom, not because I'm prurient, how long are they there? Because many things have happened in restrooms. People can start fires in a restroom. Why are they in there that long, et cetera? That's crazy, but you do it.
Yeah, and we've changed now from being passive. If there is a situation like that, your best chances, if you can't escape, the first thing is escape. Get out of the area. But if you can't do that, if you can't barricade yourself, then take action and try and distract the individuals to allow you a chance to escape.
I think all of us on planes now would be ready to attack somebody if we thought they were going to be a danger. I think we'd do that now, where we might not have 20 years ago.
Oh, we would not have 20 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is post 9/11 world.
That's
speaking
the point.
Speaking of which, it's coming up in 2 days, right?
Yep.
Okay, well, let's get – Keith has a few things he wants
here
to talk about. Let's
talk fast, Keith.
Go back to preparedness day.
you might know that we had an anhydrous leak down in Collins a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
A what?
A leak of anhydrous ammonia. A hazmat situation. It's one of those situations where we would have used what we call Story County Iowa Alerts, our mass notification system that will allow us to send you a phone voice message, a text message, or even an email of a danger like that. The key thing is we were talking about landlines. Nobody's got a landline anymore. And the only way your cell phones get registered is by actually going onto our website at www.storycountyiowa.gov/EMA. And on there, there's a chance for you to register your cell phone. You can also register, I want alerts for a particular town. So I live in Story City, and I work in Nevada, and I've got an elderly family that lives in Collins. You can select to get notifications for those towns, and also the address that you put down for your cell phone will be another way.
This is a great service. I use it, and it's great. Repeat again how you get that, because that's a really, really great thing to have.
Go to www.storycountyiowa.gov/EMA. And we don't use it for weather because it would get overused for weather. But we have used it for a boil order. But the thing is, we've never tested this system countywide. And we're going to do that on Thursday, September 27th at 10 a.m. We're going to send out a test message. So if you have signed up and you don't get a test message on Thursday, September 27th at 10 a.m., give us a call at our office at 382-7315, and we'll go into the system and see why.
Repeat that number.
382-7315. We'd like to hear from you to make sure that our system is working. And we also need training on it because we have to be able to do this quickly. And we actually have some canned messages, one for a hazardous materials situation that would have told you, you need to evacuate, go here, look for further information at our website or at our Facebook site. Because communications during a disaster, letting the public and the businesses know what they need to do to be a part of a successful response is absolutely essential.
Yeah.
And this is the way that you can find out exactly what's going on in a very, very critical situation. So get yourself signed up. Get your business signed up. Have the front desk signed up so if something happens. If you've got elderly relatives, go to their house, take their cell phone, and register for them so they know how to get it.
And this is the month to do it because it's Preparedness Month.
Preparedness Month. And we got a great suggestion from Sarah McClure, who is at the Ames Dispatch supervisor over there, said, hey, when was the last time we tested this system? Mm-hmm. That suggestion has spurred us to give this system a good run through.
Well, we got to go, I think. Keith
Morgan,
I
think we do.
Thank you very much.
Any last word, Keith?
Be safe out there.
You bet.
Okay.
You've been listening to Local Talk, and we've been your hosts, Dennis Hart and Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening.
Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also, remember, you can hear a recording of this show later online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Also, remember that we are streaming live at khoifm.org.
Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you'd like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team.
And remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Stay safe.